هون لگل اس بی اس راژیو بشی کردینا.
Earlier this week, the Victorian branch of Australian Institute of International Affairs, AIIA, ran a webinar on the Kurds in a fragmenting Middle East, presented by Dr. William Gurley, who teaches politics and international relations at Monash University and is a research associate in the Middle East Studies Forum at Deakin University. In 2016, he completed his PhD at Monash and an examination of Kurdish identity in Turkey. His research interests include clash of resistant politics and authoritarianism and issues of ethnicity, nationalism and majority-minority relations in the Middle East. Dr. Gurley also published a monograph, The Kurds in Erdogan's Turkey, this year, or in July 2020. William Gurley, welcome to SBS Kurdish.
Thank you very much, Rosa. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you. And we'll talk about the webinar that was ran this week, or earlier this week, titled The Kurds in a Fragmenting Middle East. How would you summarize, if possible, the situation of the Kurds in today's Middle East?
I have to say that the situation for Kurds across the Middle East is not particularly bright at this stage. We all know that Kurds in Iraq and Syria made some advances after the defeat of ISIS, made some territorial advances, and they won a lot of international support. And if we go back to 2015, the Kurds, via the vehicle of the HDP, won seats in the Turkish parliament. But since then, the situation has deteriorated, perhaps on all fronts. The HDP is now under extreme pressure from the Turkish government, the AKP government. A large number of its mayors and parliamentarians have been jailed on trumped-up terrorism charges. Meanwhile, in Syria, Turkey has intervened three times since 2016 in northern Syria, pushing back the Kurdish-run administration. Well, we should explain that it's the Syrian Democratic Forces who are the main military entity there, so it's not just Kurdish, but certainly in that sense, Turkey has encroached into northern Syria and pushed back the administration that is largely Kurdish-run. And in northern Iraq, following the referendum of 2017, the Iraqi Kurdish referendum of 2017, the Kurdish administration there has been pushed into a corner and has had to has lost control of some territory that it claimed, disputed territories that it claimed during the campaign against ISIS. So in that sense, the Kurdish question or Kurdish populations in all those states, and indeed in Iran where they are under extreme pressure, Kurdish populations are under a lot of pressure from state authorities and other entities.
Now, we know, for example, Turkey is known to be a Western ally, or at least it's part of the NATO. So in that sense, could we say that the Western powers and superpowers have their hands are tight in confronting Turkey on its Kurdish issue or the way they handle it? But to come into countries like Iran, that we know the US, for example, has put a lot of pressure on Iran, different administrations as well as not some more than others. But why is the Kurdish question everywhere in the Middle East put aside, or people don't want to deal with it? Why is it such a big issue?
I would argue that Western states generally have great sympathy for the Kurdish cause, but unfortunately the Kurds in all of those four countries are relatively minor players, and so Western governments have broader interests in mind but are also wary of, certainly in the case of Turkey, seeing to be too pro-Kurdish, and they don't want to upset their allies. As you note, Turkey is a member of NATO. So there's concern about if there is too much support or diplomatic push for greater rights for Kurds or whatever it might be, there's concern that that will cause criticism or upset Turkey, which certainly at this point the EU is not happy to do. And a key to that particular issue, or aside from the NATO factor, is the fact that Turkey is home to or is currently housing enormous numbers of Syrian and other refugees. So, and the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has actually stated explicitly that if the EU behaves in such a way that Turkey is displeased, they will release refugees, a wave of refugees into Europe. So in that sense, Europe is very concerned. America, again, wants to keep Turkey on side because even though there's a lot of consternation about Turkey's behaviour, it's still a member of NATO and it needs Turkey to remain a part of NATO as a buffer against Russia, which is becoming more influential and more assertive in the Middle East. So I think that the ultimate answer to your question is, while there is great sympathy for Kurds in all of the four states where they live, there are also other considerations that Western powers consider more important. And so sadly, the Kurds are often ignored or left out of the equations that are calculated.
In the webinar this week, you mentioned that democracy was the answer in the Middle East to solve not just the Kurdish problem, probably all other minority issues and oppression. Turkey, for example, has always been considered one of the most democratic states in the Middle East. It's even reported often these days that it's only gone authoritarian under Erdogan. But, if you ask the Kurdish population, they don't remember a time where Turkey has been a democratic state for them. Do you think democracy, as we know it in the West, is viable in the Middle East?
I think it is, absolutely. I think there's a great sort of stereotype that a lot of people with not a great deal of knowledge of the region say, oh, the Middle East is not ready for democracy. That's not to say that the model of democracy that we have here in Australia or in America, whatever, is immediately transferable. You just can't pick it up and go, right, here it is, take it. Democracy, I think, is viable, but it might take a different shape or a different form to what we know of it or what we know it to be in the West. My key point about democracy as a solution is based on my experience of 2015 when I was there for the election in Turkey in the middle of 2015, when the HDP, which is a pro-Kurdish party, I mean, it's not solely Kurdish, but it has a large Kurdish support base, for the first time won seats in the parliament. And my point about democracy being the solution was I saw the excitement and inspiration that spread amongst the Kurdish population. I was primarily in Diyarbakir, which is the largest Kurdish populated city in southeastern Turkey. And the sense of excitement was because they felt that they had political representation. They had a voice that was going to go into parliament and represent their interests. And so that's why I say democracy is a solution to the Kurdish issue and other issues, as you know. And it's not just Kurds in these states who are being oppressed. There's other people who are oppressed or have lack of political representation. But I saw that the population there, the Kurdish population amongst whom I moved, were so excited and they felt that they had a buy-in to politics. They were a player. And that's would be a major step towards solving the Kurdish issue. If Kurds feel that they are able to have a voice in the way their lives are run and in political processes, then that's a step towards solving the issue. And it certainly means that violent approaches or, the conflict that we've seen will be less necessary. If people have a voice, they don't need to fight. So I think it sort of comes back to that key idea. And I said in the webinar, I don't want to appear naive, because how democracy can actually flourish in Turkey, Syria, Iran and Iraq is an incredibly complex question. But that's where I see the solution lying, in the medium term, hopefully. Who knows?
Yeah, so from that point of view, how would you assess implementing or, democratizing Iraq, for example? And, it's been decades now and Iraq is still, not a state that can be called democratic or hasn't been working as a democracy up to date. How would you describe the situation there?
Well, my knowledge of Iraq is not as in-depth as it is of Turkey, I have to admit. I think I guess the key point is democracy as we understand it in the West didn't arrive overnight. There was wars and revolutions and, the Second World War. And so building and establishing and consolidating liberal democracy is a process that takes an incredibly long period of time. So, we can't sort of look at the Middle East and say, well, Europe's been democratic for 50 years. Why can't you do it? I mean, it's going to take time and there's tensions and they need to be resolved and there needs to be compromise and negotiation amongst all parties. I mean, I can't snap my fingers and say this is what they need to do, but, it's a process, process that will take time, and hopefully some of those steps are being made. You know, the very fact that there have been elections within Iraq, albeit flawed, and, you know, at certain times they were, voting was largely along sectarian lines, which isn't ideal, but hopefully, you know, baby steps will get there eventually, which might seem a little bit of a cheesy answer, but we've got to stay optimistic.
We heard in the webinar that to be realistic, the Kurds need to almost, you know, this interpretation of what was said or presented by yourself to give up the idea of nationhood or creating, you know, the Kurds often refer to that dream of a greater Kurdistan or even partial Kurdistan, like the Kurds in Iraq tried to kind of step towards in the referendum in 2017. If you could just elaborate on that realistic thinking.
A very tricky question, Rosa. You've put me on the spot.
I'm sorry.
I know that the idea of Kurdistan is incredibly strong and has a lot of support amongst Kurdish populations, you know, not only in the Middle East, but surely here in Australia and, you know, other diaspora communities as well. You know, creation of new states is incredibly complex, more so than building democracies, I would say.
Yeah, well, I think also the idea of new states or creation of state has been very rare these days, and not like, you know, the imperial powers who just drew up borders and created new states. That doesn't happen anymore unless a superpower or the superpowers are behind it. We you know, the latest we've seen was, for example, Kosovo, I should say, South Sudan, for example. Why are there are rare exemptions nowadays in modern history?
I think, again, that comes back to, well, as you say, the support of the major powers, but also sympathy for the cause. You know, there was, it was seen that the Kosovars were under undue pressure, but there was also seen to be some legitimacy to their claims, at, you know, and their aspiration towards an independent state. And I think those things are present amongst Kurds, or certainly there's sympathy from the Western powers for the Kurdish cause, as I've said a couple of times. But I think at the same time, there's also the fact that no one wants to have Turkey offside, because they're now, in my opinion, the strongest state in the immediate neighbourhood. And there's also, I think, the lessons learned from the invasion of Iraq in 2003 are that getting involved in Middle Eastern politics in an assertive way is really complex and likely to come back and bite you. So, you know, America thought it could merrily walk into Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein and create democracy and it would all be fantastic and everyone would be singing and dancing in the streets. And that's not what happened. And so even if there is this support, you know, international sympathy for the Kurdish cause, there's an understanding that creating a state is going to be incredibly complex, and there'll be blowback, and it'll be from Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Iran, and the West doesn't want that and doesn't want to get involved to that extent. So I'm not sure whether the era of creation of new state might be behind us. Perhaps that might be where we're at.
How much would you say geography has a, you know, play or impact on creation of new states? I mean, we know Kurds are landlocked, and all the states that surround that Kurdish region in the Middle East are powerful states that are against the idea. How much geography plays in the equation?
Yeah, I think that's a very important factor. And that's the very reason that Barzani's referendum in 2017 ultimately failed. Like, he made a point, he said, you know, I think it was 93% of Iraqi Kurds said, yes, we want independence. But it demonstrated that the geography that the Kurds find themselves in is against being, the geography being those surrounding states are not willing to countenance the idea. So I think perhaps a key first step, if there is to be a Kurdistan, is to foster closer relations either with Ankara or Baghdad or Damascus or Tehran. I mean, obviously that's going to be very complex because all four of those capitals are very against that, the idea. But I think some sort of recognition or agreement or conciliation with local capitals is a step towards, well, I mean, I think perhaps a first step would be negotiating for autonomy, and even that's going to be a difficult battle. But yes, it's undoubtedly the fact that geography is an important factor, because even if a Kurdistan did come to pass, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's bigger, or you know, northern Iraq, or whether it's bigger, it's landlocked, as you say, so it's entirely dependent on the goodwill of its neighbours. So there need to be strong neighbourly relations between Kurdish political actors and regional governments. And at this point, there aren't really close. I mean, I suppose the PYD in Syria has a reasonable relationship with Assad at the moment, but who knows where that may go, because Assad probably, once he's retaken Idlib, he will want to retake the Kurdish-run area in northern Syria as well. So geography is a big factor, and the four capitals have a huge role to play. But even developing closer relationships or some sort of conciliatory approaches to those governments, I think ultimately will be positive for the Kurds, even if it just means greater political rights in the four states that they live in now. And then who knows what the next steps may be, whether it's autonomy and then a long-term goal of establishing a state. But it's difficult to say.
Very complicated indeed.
Yes.
Dr. William Gulays, thank you so much for your time today, and we wish you all the very best.
All right. Thank you very much, Rosa. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
دەتەوێت بابەتی دیکەی وەک ئەمە ببیستی؟ گوێڕایرە لەسەر ئەپڵ پۆدکاست، گوگڵ پۆدکاست، سپۆتیفای یان لە هەر کوێیەک پۆدکاستەکانت بەدەست دەهێنیت.